Welcome. Reverend Frank Schaefer was the pastor at the Iona United Methodist Church in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, and he was there for 11 years as the minister. And then last December, Reverend Schaefer was defrocked and essentially removed from his post at the church by the Eastern Pennsylvania Conference Board of Ordained Ministry. His crime? He officiated at the marriage of his son. Problem for church officials is that his son is gay, and the church prohibits ministers from performing same-sex marriages. We're going to get into all the various aspects of this, because obviously it's a story that has taken Reverend Schaefer and his family down certain avenues. It has reflected on society at large, and it's, of course, touching everybody who is a member of the United Methodist Church, and that includes many of you who are here this evening. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. And first of all, I just want to say again, welcome to Aspen. And I just wanted to start by asking about the wedding. How was the wedding? It must have been really moving to do your son's wedding ceremony. How's your son doing? And how are you doing? How's your family doing?
Yes. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for coming tonight. This is a very special treat. I don't get to do this kind of interview in this forum very often, so this is very special. And thanks for your welcome. And let me just say before I answer your questions that I get welcomed like this quite a bit, and I can never get used to it because in my mind I'm always thinking, what did I do? I performed an act of love for my son. And when I stood up for him, I did stand up for him, and as well as my other gay children, and I was standing for all LGBT brothers and sisters in the church, but I did what probably most people would have done anyway. So I don't really see myself as a hero, but I think this should be the normal, that you stand on the grounds of your conscience and what your heart tells you to do, that is the right thing to do. So thank you again for that welcome. And to answer your question about the wedding, it was a beautiful event. It was a very private event. Now, I didn't have the wedding at my church in Pennsylvania. We did it in Massachusetts, where gay marriage was legal at the time. It was in 2007. It had been legal for 4 years already. And it was 300 miles away from my church where I was ministering in Pennsylvania. It happened in a restaurant, so we had the ceremony there, and then followed by all the festivities, and it was beautiful. But 120, 130 people were there, mostly family and friends, close friends, and it was beautiful. And my son asked me to perform the wedding. It was a no-brainer for me. I said, absolutely, son. I felt honored that he asked me. Felt overjoyed, and it was my first gay marriage I did, so I had to do some research in terms of how to phrase certain things, which I gladly did, and the ceremony was received very well, and so it was a beautiful thing. This whole thing came out 6 years later, almost 6 years after it happened, because of some quarrels within my local church, and I had some trouble with some people there for various issues, and so they found out about the wedding. They somebody actually drove to Massachusetts, to Boston, to find the records, the court records. They made a copy or got a transcript of the record, the wedding record with my signature on it, and they filed an official complaint against me. Now, my son actually was a witness in my trial, and for him that wasn't easy because he told his story of how, you know, as a young teenager at age 12, 13, how he accompanied me to a conference, an annual conference at the time, and it just so happened that year there was a debate on the floor about homosexuality, and it was fierce, and there were some very hurtful things said, hurtful to him, unbeknownst to me. I didn't know at the time that he was gay and struggling with his sexual orientation. And so the church that he grew up in, the church that he loved, and his faith was always very important to him, basically told him that day, you know, we think you're a freak and you're outside of the grace of God. This was the very first time that my son realized my own church is actually saying that if you're homosexual, that's not okay. You know, you're going to hell. And so he really suffered from that. He wondered about his salvation. He got to a point where he cried himself to sleep. This is what he testified. He prayed to God, please make me normal. I don't want to be this way. And it got to a point where he was considering taking his own life. And it was very serious. He had already a plan in place at one point. So when he came out to us and we learned about all these things, we just embraced him, of course. And we said, Tim, we love you. And we will always love you, no matter who or what you are. And obviously, quite obviously, you did not choose this, or else you wouldn't have prayed this prayer. You wouldn't have gone through the struggle that you have gone through. So this is the way God created you, gay and all. You're a beautiful man created in God's image, just like everybody else. And so we had affirmed him all these years, and he shared about that in the witness stand. And so when it came to the time of the wedding, he said, it was actually not easy for him to ask that question. But he knew that I would be upset if he didn't ask me that question. So he asked it, even though he knew I was probably going to be in trouble. And he asked the question, and of course I said yes. I mean, after all these years of affirming him in his faith, in as a person, of who he was as a gay man, for me to have said no to him, that would have been terrible. It would have negated all of those affirmations. And so there comes a time in every person's life, I think, when you have to walk the walk and not just talk the talk. And that, to me, was that time. And I said yes, and I was overjoyed. And then I realized that I might be in trouble with my church, because my church does not allow for United Methodist ministers to perform same-sex marriages. So he testified about this struggle and about how it affected him emotionally. And so we thought, my wife and I thought, and by the way, my wife is here tonight too, so Bridget. And so we thought, Bridget and I thought, that maybe, this would really affect him in a very negative way. And there were some signs that we thought, oh no, he's reliving some of these emotions. But then we were also quite surprised of how little time it took him to come around. And he's in a much better place now. In fact, he's still involved in a United Methodist Church, very active. He is going to a reconciling United Methodist Church, as much as this church is a reconciling church, has been for, I don't think people really know how long you've been reconciling. Early 90s already. Wow. That's amazing. You must have been one of the first churches. That's just amazing. And so he feels welcome there. And his pastor is a gay man. And so he feels very welcome there. And he's very active in that church. And so he's doing okay. It took all of us, my wife, myself, all of our children, quite some time. And actually, we're still struggling with some parts of that. Because it wasn't just the trial. It was also the turmoil we faced in the local congregation for about half a year before the trial actually started. And that was very painful, to see some very meaningful relationships break over the division that was caused by the issue and by the complaint being brought forth. And then the trial itself, which was also very, very emotional for all of us. We ran the whole gamut of emotions through the trial. Sometimes we felt good because, we thought we put on a good defense. And then, when the verdict came in guilty, then we were really frustrated and really disappointed. And so we felt all of those emotions, and it wasn't easy. But since then, a lot of things have happened. Even though I lost my credentials, my official credentials, and I was defrocked by the church, immediately after that happened, the day after that happened, I started getting phone calls from people like Pastor Jane all around the country. And so it's just amazing how one part of the church rejected me, and another part of the church, the LGBT community and supporters of the church, said, not so fast. He's not done yet. And so I'm happy to report that I'm actually preaching now every Sunday through the month of June, except for Easter Sunday. For a defrocked minister, I'm awfully busy, I have to tell you. And there was a third part to the question that...
How are you and your family doing?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And so we are actually... This is healing for us. You know, traveling around the country, not only seeing beautiful places like Aspen, but also meeting folks like you that are so supportive, and pastors like Pastor Jane that are so supportive. And it really restores our faith, even in the United Methodist Church. And so we're healing, and we're being encouraged, and we're doing much better.
Well, I want to talk about the trial a little bit, because it turns out that you do this very personal ceremony, and you have been accused of violating the Methodist Church's Book of Discipline. So you're put on trial, and the first thing imagery came to my mind was medieval, Copernicus, Galileo, right? How can we go around the sun? And they're put on trial. Tell us about the trial. I mean, was it like a regular courtroom? Where did it take place? What were the kinds of questions? Did you have defenders and prosecutors and all of that?
Yes, those are very good questions, because I wasn't aware of what a church trial was before I actually faced one. First of all, the discipline is our law book in the United Methodist Church. So we have our own very own law book, and this is the grounds for the trial. This is what you need to refer to, just like you would at a civil court or at a criminal court. You have the law books, and so we have our law books, and that's called the discipline. And yes, the church trial was very much like a civil trial. So there was a judge, a retired bishop in this case, was appointed to be the presiding officer, is what we call it. There was a jury of my peers, all United Methodist ministers from my area, from my conference. And you had a counsel for the church, the prosecution, and you had the complainant with his counsel, and then there was the defense table, and of course I was a part of that, and then we had supporters. We had 10 seats each on each side that we could bring in people, consultants, witnesses, family members, friends, and then it was actually opened up to the audience. There were probably about 150, 200 people at that trial, and so it felt like a regular trial. There was a jury selection. They were drawn from a jury pool of about 95 ministers, and there were questions being presented, you know, to sort of narrow them down to 13 jurors and two alternates, and then the trial began.
So I read that you plan to appeal, and I wonder, where is that? Have you appealed, and where are you in that process?
Yes, actually, this is recent news, because my appeal will be heard before the Northeastern Jurisdictional Council. And that council is made up of lay members as well as clergy members from all the conferences that are in that area of the North, you know, Eastern Conference area. I just got news that they will have a hearing for my appeal. So it's been granted. And now we wait to hear exactly what date and what location, and the appeal is based on the penalty. I had a choice also to appeal certain procedural things that happened during the trial, but I asked my counsels, what does this mean? If I won based on these appeals, would I have to face another trial? And they said yes. Then they would declare mistrial and do another one. And I said to them, look, I really can't do another trial. You know, and my family can't do another trial. We can't do another trial. So we're just appealing on the basis of the penalty. And we think we have good grounds that that possibly my credentials will be restored, that I'll be reinstituted into the church. So fingers crossed.
Yes, fingers crossed. And I suspect they're going to have to get a larger venue. There'll probably be more than 150 people there, I would suspect.
Yeah, I have no idea what they have planned in that regard, but there might actually be a possibility that this may be more open to the public than my last trial, which they tried to really keep under wraps.
The United Methodist Church appears to me to have some contradictory stands on the issue of gays and lesbians. On the one hand, everybody's welcome to be a member. Doesn't matter. You can be gay. You can be a member. But then when it comes to marriage, we see what has happened to you. How can those two conflicts exist in this church?
And that's just the point that I'm trying to make everywhere that I made in front of my jury. I said, look, on the one hand, we say in our book of discipline, all people are of sacred worth, and we specifically mention homosexual people. And then on the other hand, we say that the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teachings. So we say, oh yeah, you can come to our church, you can attend, you can become a member, you can be baptized, you can even, you know, fill certain positions in the church, but when it comes to ordination, no, that's where we draw the line. When it comes to gay marriage, no, we can't allow you to marry the partner of your choice and the one that you love. And to me, that clearly is discrimination. That is treating some of our people as second-class Christians. And that's just not right. That's so obvious to me that this is discrimination. I can't believe that we still have, you know, these discriminatory stipulations in our book of discipline.
We were chatting a little bit before this about the idea of being a biblical scholar. You, in essence, have a master's degree, correct, in studying the Bible. I'm wondering, what does the Bible actually say about prohibiting being gay or prohibiting gay marriage?
Yeah, and I think that's the crux of the problem right now. We have a lot of literalists, even in the United Methodist Church, that want to say, well, there are these 7-8 passages in the Old Testament and New Testament that say that homosexuality is sinful and exclude, you know, people from the same rights as it is extended to other Christians and other believers. And I do have a master's degree in as a pastor, and of course a lot of those studies centered around the biblical passages, biblical scriptures, as well as learning Hebrew and Greek and all those other neat things. My answer in this debate is that you can't be a literalist on some passages and then on other passages say, well, yeah, but here we need to consider the context and we need to use interpretation. And that's the thing that really vexes me in my talks with literalists. So just recently, to name an example, I read out loud to a literalist that I was discussing this issue with from Exodus 21:7. And I read out loud that verse, which gives specific instructions on how to sell your daughter into slavery. And after I had read that, you know, he was saying, well, yeah, no. First I asked, well, do you believe that this is the word of God as well? I mean, you told me you take everything literal in the Bible. And then he said, well, no, you have to consider the context. And I'm saying, aha, so you do interpret. But they say they don't, but they do. And then, you know, when you get into the discussion of those things, then it turns out, yes, everybody interprets the scriptures. And we have to, because there are so many things in the Bible that need to be interpreted, because now we have new knowledge about humanity, about our physical world. There are passages in the scriptures that talk about the four corners of the earth, meaning the earth is flat. Not only flat, but apparently also a square. Now, we no longer believe that. And it took the church, you know, quite some time to really acknowledge all of these things, but eventually the church did. So we have really, you know, come a long way on many, many issues. And that's just one of the issues. We have the issue of slavery. We have the issue of women in the clergy. We have the issue of women and children being seen as property of men. And all of these things we have abandoned and are now saying, well, that needs interpretation. We need to see this in the right context of the cultural values of the time. But when it comes to this passage, where it says in Leviticus, a man shall not lie with a man with a woman. That's an abomination unto God. Now that we take literal. But in the same chapter, it also talks about not eating pork and not eating shrimp, and we really enjoy that today, not getting tattoos. And a lot of Christians, you know, think that's okay today. But that one thing we pick out and say, well, but that we can see literal. We can interpret literally. And that's just not fair. And that's not consistent, and it's not right. And by the way, if you really do a study on these passages, none of these passages in the Old Testament or New Testament talk about a loving, committed homosexual relationship. None of them. They're always in the context of either rape or temple prostitution, of unnatural behaviors, as it says in Romans. They're never talking about a loving, committed homosexual relationship.
What about Jesus? Did Jesus say anything directly or indirectly that related to this issue?
Absolutely not. Jesus never mentioned anything about homosexuality. And my argument is, if it had been that important of an issue, why didn't Jesus say anything about it?
I've read a couple of accounts of the historical Jesus, so I'm no expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm wondering if there's an analogy perhaps in the story of Jesus and the lepers. And as I understand it, leprosy, it was a disease, but it was also considered by the priests at the temple to be a sign of impurity, a sign of sin. And in order to pray at the temple, a leper had to go through an extensive and very expensive series of rituals to be cleansed enough to go into the temple. Jesus comes along and says, "You're healed for free." And this was part of what he was railing against the priests and the running of the temple. I don't mean that there's necessarily an analogy between leprosy and homosexuality, but is there an analogy perhaps in how he dealt with these people and how the church is now dealing with gays and lesbians?
I absolutely see a parallel there. I mean, the lepers were untouchable at the time. And here comes Jesus. And what does he do? The first thing he does, he touches them. You know, he hugs them. He literally touches them and he heals them. There is a parallel in other ways as well. I mean, you know, he was said to surround himself with the worst of sinners. Now, Jesus never called these people sinners. You know, tax collectors and former prostitutes, even murderers like St. Paul, used to, you know, murder Christians, persecute Christians. He called them friends. They were his friends. That was his circle of friends, besides, you know, the disciples and some other people as well. But what Jesus showed us, not just taught us, but showed us in his entire ministry, is that you are definitely not allowed, as a believer, whether you're a Jewish believer or a Christian, whatever believer you are, you're not allowed to marginalize anybody, any person. He included everybody in his ministry. He welcomed everybody in. He consorted with everybody, even the then hated and despised Samaritans. You know, he talked theology with women, and that was an offense. And he had a beef with his religious leadership at the time, which eventually caused him to die on the cross. So he was definitely a rebel rouser, and he was teaching us it's not okay to harm or hurt or exclude any of God's beloved children.
So how does this get missed in the Book of Discipline, this contradiction?
Yes, it's a very blatant contradiction, and people are aware of it. And so even my bishop, after the trial, came out saying that, yes, these stipulations are discriminatory, and we do speak of out of both sides of our mouths. She does actually say that and has stated it in writing to the press even. I don't understand myself how people can miss that important point, that really the basis of Christianity is love. How can you miss that? Jesus was so clear in it. You know, we only have really one passage where Jesus gives us a clue of the way in which we should interpret the Bible. And that is when he was asked, what is the most important law of Moses in the Torah? And he said, the most important law is love God, but one that is equal to it is love your neighbor as yourself. And that is the lens through which we should interpret all of the law. Because he said those are the most important laws, and all other laws follow from them. That is the lens. And if you view all scripture through the lens of love for God and love for your neighbor, how can you come up with a law that discriminates against anybody?
You mentioned the analogy of slavery. I would say let's move forward a little bit to civil rights in the 1960s. And once these rules changed regarding race, many religions updated themselves to reflect that. That's what's happening right now. In fact, today, a judge struck down Michigan's ban on gay marriage. So the courts are acting, society's changing. You're in the middle of it. It may be difficult for you to sort of see where this is going, but what's your prediction? Is the church going to move itself along, to catch up with what society seems to be doing?
I personally believe that it's only a matter of time. Change is coming. And I believe we will see a change, even in the United Methodist Church. Now, there are factors that really have a tendency to slow us down on the change. And part of that has to do because we're a global church, and where the growth is happening in our United Methodist Church right now is in Africa and Asia. And here in the United States and in Europe, we're shrinking in membership. So that more and more delegates are being sent from the Central Conference in Africa and Asia, and so that is potentially slowing us down because attitudes toward homosexuality are very conservative, as you know, coming out of Africa, and there are also some in the church, some conservatives who are saying, acknowledging, yes, the church has changed in terms of women in the clergy, the civil rights movement, segregation, and all of those things, they were not okay, and slavery, of course, is included in that as well. But they say, this is different. You know, the teaching about homosexuality is different, and the church is not going to change on that. So it's a real challenge, and I think it is very important for me to be an activist from within the church, because you can change the law. And that's good, and we need that. And most of the times, that is what is changing society. But will it really change attitudes, in people's hearts? That's I think something that is very much influenced by religion. And so we need to really bring education on this issue to the church, and we need to tell people, look, this is not the only way to interpret these passages. Yes, you may have heard this growing up in the church. And it's very unfortunate, but there are other ways of seeing these scriptures in context. And so it's very important, I think, for us in the church, in reconciling churches and pastors who are enlightened, like Pastor Jane, to really bring these points out again and again and let people know that this is discrimination and we need to change it. This is not in the spirit of Jesus. And we need to change those laws, and we need to change those attitudes as well.
So what is the structure then within the church to change the book of discipline? I mean, is this something that, how does one update the book of discipline?
Yeah, it's actually a very political process, not unlike legislation being brought through a court system. Here you have General Conference, which only meets every 4 years, and you have delegates from all over the world. So then legislation is actually brought on the floor, it's being proposed, and then it's being discussed on the floor, and then there's a vote. And so, because large parts of the delegation are conservative, we have in the past not made any progress with regards to getting rid of some of those homophobic laws and the homophobic language. Now, some of the conservatives are saying, well, this has been the traditional teaching of the church, and we can't abandon that. And then we find out, oh, no, this homophobic language and these homophobic stipulations have only been introduced in 1972 for the first time. That's when it entered into the discipline. So I'm saying, no, we need to get back to the traditional teaching and take those homophobic laws out of our discipline. But it is a very difficult process, and I fear that that this will lead to a splintering or a split of the church before it gets changed in the actual discipline. I think we're going to go through something, unfortunately, again, because I'm hearing it not only from conservatives. Now, the conservatives have been harping on this for years. They've said, you know, this could lead to a split, and they threatened a split. And now I'm hearing it from the progressive side as well, especially after my trial. This has really rattled the church and really rallied the base in terms of the progressive saying enough is enough. There needs to be change, and if there is no change, then we need to consider a split. So now both sides are talking about the split, and that may be indicative of what's coming.
We were talking about, how does one miss the contradiction of who Jesus ministered to? Another sort of historic fact seems to be that the more you try to silence someone, the louder their voice becomes. Happens time and time again. You are now preaching every Sunday. You're busier than you were before.
Yeah, it's amazing how that happens sometimes. You know, what people meant for harm, you know, God took and really turned into a ministry of healing. I can't even tell you how many times I go to churches and I preach. And a lot of times these are reconciling churches or churches that are on their way to becoming reconciling churches. Reconciling in our lingo means becoming open and affirming of everybody, including same gender couples and everybody, and extending full rights to everybody. So oftentimes after I preach and after I share my story, people will come up to me and many times tears in their eyes, saying, "We have never heard anybody say this in church. You know, that I, as a gay man, am loved, am a beloved child of God, and there's nothing wrong with that, and that we have the same rights as everybody else." And they're touched by the story of how I stood up for my son, and really through standing up for my son, also stood up for every LGBT member in the church. And so they're so touched by that, and it becomes a moment of healing. You know, what I'm seeing at that moment in those tears is not just, you know, the tears of joy, but it's also an aspect of grief, an aspect of pain. You know, I realize that these tears are flowing because for years and years and years, you know, they have heard these hurtful and harmful messages and hate messages, really, from the church. And now they feel things are changing, and they are just so glad. And so deeply touched by that, so it becomes a moment of healing, and so that's what I'm experiencing right now. And I think it's marvelous that that this happens again and again in the history of the church, and that God is saying, "Not so, you know, you may try to silence somebody who's standing up for the rights of other people, for the inclusion of other people, for love and for unconditional love and for the grace of God." But God is empowering these people sometimes in church history and bringing moments of healing and joy, you know, to the church through these people and change.
We want to get to some questions from the audience. Anything you want to kind of add as to wrap this up?
Well, let me just share with you that a lot of times when I speak in United Methodist churches, and I speak in other churches as well, but a lot of times when I speak in United Methodist churches, people tell me how upset they are about what happened to me, about me being defrocked. And so this happened about 5 weeks ago in a church in New York, upstate New York, in Binghamton. An older lady, she had been a United Methodist for all her life, came up during a Q&A session and said, "Reverend Schaefer, I want you to know that I am so upset at what they did to you, this defrocking. I'm using that word now as a cuss word." And then she actually gave an example of how she's using it and said, "What the fuck is going on in my church?" But the story continues. So then I share this the very next week at the Cathedral of Hope in Dallas, Texas. And there's one artist in this congregation, unbeknownst to me. He heard this and actually made a bumper sticker that says, "What the frock? Love is the law."
That's excellent. Thank you. Questions? Don.
Reverend Schaefer, do you think that your colleagues that sat on the jury at your trial convicted you of violating the discipline? So was it the fact that you violated the discipline, the letter of the law, or was it that you performed a homosexual marriage? Do you understand what I'm saying? Was it a letter of the law decision? And the other thing I'm curious about is, how frequent does the Methodist Church, have a church trial? I mean, does it have to rise to the level of your offense, or does anybody that violates the discipline go through this?
Yeah, to answer your last question first, the last shall be first, right? There aren't many church trials based on LGBTQ issues. Maybe a handful, maybe six or seven in the last 10, 12 years. And not many lead to a defrocking. I'm only one of three, actually, that were defrocked by the church in the last 12 years, or ever, really, on this issue. And then secondly, the jury, yes, I believe there was a variety of ministers on that jury, and one juror actually contacted me after this was all over, and she said this was the hardest thing for her that she had to do. She is totally on my side, on the side of the LGBT community and their rights, and she tried to make her influence count on the jury in the deliberations and was unsuccessful. And she said it was horrible for her to sit there, you know, with the other jurors as the verdict was read. And it was just horrible. So she said she suffered so much that I would have to visit her church now and speak at her church, which I did. I that's on my calendar, so I'm going to speak at her church. And then I've also heard from others that, you know, they really didn't make this decision on LGBT rights, but on what you said, on the letter of the law, because the church council, the prosecution, really pushed for that. You know, they really were saying, yeah, you know, you may have one opinion on this, but that doesn't matter here. You need to judge on account of what it says in the discipline, and the discipline prohibits United Methodist ministers from performing same-sex marriages, so you must vote guilty. And I think they were swayed by that. Instead of saying, no, we're going to take a different perspective on this and say these are unjust laws, which would have been another way to go, but they were swayed by the prosecution for the church and voted me guilty, and, you know, voted on the guilty verdict.
So the verdict wasn't unanimous?
No, it wasn't unanimous. It was on... I had two charges against me. One charge was, did I perform that wedding? And that was unanimous. Obviously, I did. I mean, I never said I didn't do it. So, but the second one was that I violated the order and discipline of the United Methodist Church, and that one received 9 votes for and 4 against.
What I worry about, and I'm wondering whether you share my concern, is that this type of action by the church will lose parishioners rather than gain them.
I think you're absolutely right, and not only are you right on that statement, but I think the church is understanding that now, because I believe one reason why Reverend Ogletree's trial was dropped is because the church realized this had consequences for the church. I believe there was a price tag on my trial. It was around $100,000, but I think the real price tag was much, much, much greater than that, because so many people left the church, even pastors that turned in their credentials. so many parishioners just said, that's it, I'm not supporting this church. I think there were probably, you're talking about millions probably that the church lost just over my trial recently, because it was publicized so widely, and the church didn't think that was going to happen. So yes, absolutely.
In the news coverage surrounding the trial, I believe I read at one point that a bishop from a California conference somewhere invited you to join that conference. Is a trial in defrocking system-wide in all Methodist churches, or can another conference invite you to become another minister?
Refrock you.
Yes. Yes. This is also a very good question. And the short answer is no. Bishop Carcano really wasn't supposed to do that. This is not something that the United Methodist Church does. If one annual conference defrocks a minister, that minister is not supposed to be invited by another conference to be a minister. So this really shows the division in the church. And it also encourages our movement, the LGBTQ movement, because it is saying now that, okay, so, you know, same-sex marriages happen all over the place within the United Methodist Church now. And so the consequences for, even if it comes to a defrocking, even then, there is another part of the church that says, well, we don't accept what happened to you. We believe you did the right thing, and we want to invite you to come over to our annual conference and be a United Methodist minister here. And so that's actually, we're in process of still exploring that, and actually it looks like we may end up in California ministering to a United Methodist church come July. That's why I'm keeping my schedule open. Yeah. Yeah, this is really positive for our church. And then there are other instances, like, you know, dropping the case for Ogletree. There was another ruling by a bishop on the West Coast, the California-Nevada conference. There were two complaints against ministers who did same-sex marriages, and it never came to a trial. The bishop just punished these two ministers by giving them each a 24-hour suspension, which I call a vacation day. So that's another good thing.
Well, I wanted to amplify one of the questions here. We talked about how do you change the Book of Discipline. Could it be changed through a trial? And could an appeal be that trial? You said you were up on essentially two charges. One, did you actually do it? Yes. You admitted to that. Did you violate the Book of Discipline? Maybe not so sure on that. Could a trial be the basis of a change to that book?
That's ingenious. I mean, I don't know if it's possible, but I have never heard that suggestion before. You might have something there. Wow. Huh. I'm going to find out about that. Wow.
You heard it first here, folks.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Again, a very good question. I should have mentioned that when I explained, you know, what a church trial actually is and looks like. Now, everybody who's appointed in that trial is a clergy person. So the jury is made up of all clergy persons. The judge is a bishop. The prosecutor is also a clergy person, and so it was my counsel, the counsel for the defense. Now, just to make sure that everything goes according to the law of the Book of Discipline, we also have attorneys. So the bishop had an attorney, which was actually the chancellor, the highest lawyer attorney that the church has. He is the attorney for the Council of Bishops by his side. I had an attorney. The Council for the Church had an attorney. And so everybody is lawyered up just to make sure that everything is going according to plan. And the truth is that the lawyers are the ones that do all the legwork and write most of the statements, and then it's up to the clergy persons to actually present it.
Well, I have a two-part question. One is, first of all, do you think that it had something to do with your particular conference that that's why the decision was made for the more conservative area of the country? And then the second part is, do you know or have you heard if other ministers throughout the country are either being emboldened to
Oh, yes, absolutely. It depends on where you are geographically in the United Methodist Church. So my conference is rather conservative, and actually there's a history there. My conference also defrocked Beth Strout. So my conference is single-handedly responsible for two defrockings out of three total in the entire United Methodist Church. So I do come from a rather conservative conference, and this would have never happened in other conferences like the entire West Coast, or even New England, or the Baltimore-Washington conference. There's a funny story I have to share with you there. Dean Snyder, who is he was my pastor now because I joined his church after I was defrocked. He is the pastor of the Foundry United Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. He is a part of a very liberal and progressive conference, the Baltimore-Washington Conference. He was at the trial, at my trial, in the back, and there were some reporters standing around, and everybody heard it in the crowd. He said, "Well, I did about a dozen of same-sex marriages. No big deal." So he was blurting it out, and that just goes to show, and he was comfortable doing it because he knows there is not a single person in his conference who would actually bring a complaint. And here I am in the Eastern Pennsylvania Conference who's going through a trial like this. You know, it really shows the division, you know, that is so much of a reality. And I really emphasize the division because this is something that the leadership of the United Methodist Church up until my trial has really tried to de-emphasize. That it was always that talk of, no, we're united, we see it this way, and, you know, just look at general conferences and at our discipline, it has not changed, and so the majority of the people believe this, and there are just a few that are violators. And I think what happened after my trial is that it really, and this is the second part of your question, it really has rattled the church, and especially the progressives. I've heard from many people that up until my trial, people did not believe that there was going to be another defrocking. You know, they thought, well, we have come a long way. Things are changing in society, even in our church. And yeah, he may get a slap on the wrist and be sent off and continue to be a minister. But when I was defrocked, that was a wake-up call for everybody in the church. And I think now we're very much aware of how divided we are and that something has to happen. And yes, there are many, many examples of people that quoted my trial and the outcome of my trial as something they did in their ministry. You know, there's a blog now in the New York conference where every week another minister comes out sharing about a same-sex wedding that he or she has done in the past. Reverend McIlvaney was so emboldened as to perform a same-sex marriage in Texas just five weeks ago. And I met him when I was in Texas, and I met the couple, Jack and George, a great couple. They've been together for 50 years. They finish each other's sentences. They're just a delight. You can't imagine George without Jack and Jack without George. You just can't, you know. And so he did this marriage, and it was of course a church marriage. It wasn't a legal marriage. It's not legal in Texas yet. And he did it because he realized through my trial that we need to do something. We need to create a new reality. And we need to stand up and be obedient to the Bible rather than the book of discipline. And so he was discharged also and suspended. I just heard about that today, actually. So. No, there's a complaint against him. And so he was suspended until this is resolved. although I fear it might never get to a trial because he also is suffering from cancer, lung cancer. No, it was liver cancer, I believe. So,
can I just add one thing here too? That it seems to me that among the people that find what happened to you terrible, it's even more terrible because you married you did the ceremony of your own son. It's much more personal here.
Yeah, and you know, that I think that is the reason why many people wanted to silence me, because it is a story that hits home. Even many conservative members of my church at Iona that I ministered at the time, when this came out, when this complaint came out, even a lot of my conservative friends in the church said, well, yeah, I'm against gay marriage rights, but it was his son. It was his son, and I would have done the same thing for my children. You know, and it's a story that really connects with people on a very, very personal level, because now you're talking not about them out there, but you're talking about a beloved family member, your own son or your own daughter, your own parent, your own uncle, aunt, and it really drives that message home, and that's why conservatives really, you know, try to silence me, because they realize this is a powerful story that has the potential to really change a lot of things in the church.
Tom?
Yes, Reverend Schaefer, Roger mentioned Copernicus and Galileo. We had the Protestant Reformation in reaction to rigidity within the Roman Catholic Church, and my minister has been talking about a change into a faith of the Spirit. So you mentioned that new reality in the larger picture, above and beyond the specific issue that has brought this to the fore, do you see the church evolving into a much more inclusive institution rather than the rigidity of the Methodist discipline or the Roman Catholic College of Cardinals or whatever?
Yeah, I personally believe that that's what the church has to do. If the church stops evolving, it ceases to be the church. Because, I mean, look at the younger generations, you know. There's a definite shift that we're seeing here to the younger generation. This is not even a question. They're scratching their head why we're even talking about this. You know, this is a no-brainer for them. Is it what? What? You what? You can't marry gay people in the church? That's ridiculous, you know. So if the church doesn't get with it, you know, soon, very soon, you know, we're going to die, because the younger generation is not subscribed to this crap. Sorry, but it really is.
Thank you.
Reverend Schaefer, how much
does
early your faith shaken by all this, not your faith in your God, but your faith in your church?
Yeah, that's also a very good question. My faith was absolutely shaken by this experience in the church. Even my faith in God was shaken by this. I was really at a point where I was thinking ahead before the trial, when it looked really grim, because of the pre-trial deliberations where I wasn't allowed to say this in court, I wasn't allowed to argue with one portion of the discipline over against another. You know, I was basically just allowed to say in the witness stand, I did it. That's what they wanted me to do. You know, it's like, wow, this is not really a fair trial. And so I really lost, you know, almost lost my faith in God. You know, I was even thinking, would I even go to church after this? You know, if I get defrocked and if, you know, if the church is going to act that way. But I have to say, even at the trial, to see that many supporters, people with rainbow stoles, filling that courtroom, and the support I got from people, and the way they shared with me, I'm praying for you, and we're behind you, and is there anything we can do? And then after my defrocking, to receive this phone call from Bishop Carcano the very next day to say, Frank, we believe in you. What you did is the right thing. It's in the spirit of Jesus. We want you to come and minister over here in California. And for Pastor Jane and so many dozens of others to call me and invite me to minister and to speak, it has really restored my faith, not only in God, but in the church as well. And in a sense, I'm in a much better place now. because I finally, after all these years of being a silent supporter, I now have the freedom to come out and say whatever I feel about the subject, and it feels like I came out of the closet finally, you know? So that's really remarkable, and it's a good feeling.
I know that I'm always raised Methodist, and you know, I think I really didn't realize what it meant to be Methodist until I came to this church, and you know, Reverend Miles, he did such a beautiful job of like explaining. He's so open-minded, and he always brings all kinds of different lessons into his ministry. And it just made me proud. Open hearts, open minds, open doors, because that's kind of how I've lived my life, and it's something that I always felt that was great pride being Methodist, and I'm open-minded, and my church supports my journey, and that is part of what is an experience to God. Whatever it is, good, the bad, the wrong turns, the right turns, everything. And so it seems like this is just brought this to a head, and this is just kind of a matter of time, because we, you know, we're saying we say we're open hearts, we say we're open minds, we say we're open doors, but yet there was a door closed for you, and so it just, you know, it's nice to hear that this continues, the story's continuing for you, and I kind of think one of my first thoughts was too, this is might lead to split in the church, because you know, I live in Memphis, Tennessee now, and you know, I know our minister at our church wrote a letter in support of you, and you know, I think there was some concern about that, and so you know, I'm in a very conservative area, but I think as people start to like, I just wish you could have this recorded and sent, because I think if people could really sit down and listen and think about what they're saying, or think about what they believe, then they might change their minds to really understand what it means to truly be open-minded and not just say it.
Yeah, this is excellent what you're saying, but let me just add to this that I truly believe that we as Methodists truly are open-minded, open-hearted, and have open doors for everybody. I think that's who we are as a people, traditionally have been. I mean, we're a big tent. We are a very diverse church, always have been. And in the spirit of Wesley and even Otterbein and Albright, you know, some of the church founders together with Wesley, with whom we merged, there has always been the sense of going to include everybody. Everybody on the margin. I mean, Wesley is the perfect example, who ministered in the streets, and he went into the prison system, which was a horrible system at the time. And even there is an example of how he, in the write-up, in historic write-up, of how he stood in court with what they called a sodomite at the time, a homosexual, to be on his side, to be his clergy counsel. And we've always, you know, reached out and been proud of the fact that we are a diverse people, and yet we're united, you know. And I believe we, and I talk about a captivity, I call it the homophobic captivity, that we've come under since 1972, but that is not really a true reflection of who we are as Methodists. And I think we need to get back to our roots, you know, to being the accepting and loving and wonderful people and diverse people that we are, really, truly at heart.
It was good to hear you talk about supporters of the courtroom. Was there a contingent of the other side? Did it become a big battle, like in the movies, with people chanting back and forth? Or
Actually, there was some of that, even though the ruling was very strong in the deliberations that people were not allowed to wear anything with words on them. You know, the rainbow stole was okayed, and so that's what people wore. There was not supposed to be any singing or chanting or anything like that. But it all did come to a head a couple of times when the Council for the Church gave a horrible, horrible closing statement on day one of the trial, where he quoted from Jude and basically told the jury they would go to hell if they didn't vote to remove my credentials, to find me guilty. And it was so horrible. It was so hurtful to, you have to consider these are, a lot of them were LGBT folks themselves or supporters. It was so horrible that there was a gasp going around the room, and I heard it behind me. And then I looked around because I heard a noise, and I saw that they rose to their feet. They were standing in protest of what they were hearing of the speech. And the church council stopped and looked around and was expecting the bishop, the judge, to reprimand the people and ask them to leave or sit down. And it never happened. So then he reluctantly, and he actually said something. And then the bishop just said, well, you're almost at the end. Just continue. And then in the sidebar, on the next day, the church council brought it up and said, Bishop, you ruled that there won't be any show of protest. And then when on the next day, when there was an applause by my supporters for something my witness said, that's when he stepped in and he actually reprimanded the crowd. And he did it in his southern accent. And that was very charming, by the way. And he said something, I thought, boy, only people from the South can be so charming when they rebuke people at the same time. He said, and if this happens again, we will invite you to leave. I was like, I thought, that's a great way to put that, very polite way to put that. But he was, he was upset. And so there were those moments during the trial. Let me just share this very important moment of the trial when I really felt my supporters were there for me. It was on day two when I was called into the witness stand again, and I had made a decision going into the stand, I would have to be honest with my jury. And so I let my counsels know right before I went up. I let them know, I have to tell them where I stand. I can't avoid the questions like we talked about and say this but not that and formulate things this way so that, I won't get in trouble. I said, I'm going to have to be honest and just tell them how I really feel about these matters. And so I sat in the stand, which is an oxymoron. I sat in the witness stand. And I felt sick to my stomach because I knew how momentous this was and that I would probably lose my credentials over this. But I knew I had to say these words, but I wasn't sure if they were going to come out right because I felt sick to my stomach. When you're sick to your stomach, you feel weak. So I wasn't sure if I could even, get the words out. And so I looked over to my family, where my family sat, and I saw all these people sitting there in their rainbow stoles. And at that moment, it felt like there was strength coming into me because of their prayers and their presence and their support. And I started to talk to the jury, and the words just flowed, and they came out just right. And I said to them, if I'm going to be a United Methodist minister tomorrow, I want you to know, my jury, that I will continue to minister to everybody, regardless of their sexual orientation. And I called those laws that prohibit our homosexual brothers and sisters to become ministers in the United Methodist Church. I called those laws that prohibit pastors to perform same-sex marriages discriminatory, and I said that the hate speech of the church has to stop. And those words just flowed out. And I was amazed. And later on, when I got the transcript, I wanted to know, did they really come out that way, the way I remember them? So I read through it, and I was like, wow, this is really extraordinary, because I felt so intimidated and weak at that moment. And it reminded me of the verse in Acts where it says, when they persecute you, when they put you in front of trials and juries, don't worry about the words. I will give you the right words to say. That's how I felt looking back what happened at that moment. So it was huge that those supporters were in the room with me all the time and were encouraging me and praying for me. It made a difference.
I think we're going to wrap up. I had one question. We've been talking about analogies and so forth, and you've said that we're at a turning point. We're reaching that tipping point, you said, I think, in this church. I wonder if there's some analogy out there that the Reverend Fred Phelps passed away. Because a lot of people, even in the gay community, are saying that perhaps the Westboro Baptist Church and their antics pushed this more towards the tipping point, that people who are homophobic said, well, I'm homophobic, but I'm not that bad. And so, you know.
I absolutely believe that is right. That's a true statement. I believe that organizations like the Westboro Baptist Church have really been helpful in that they have shown how ugly the rejection looks, how ugly it looks when people actually stand up and say, you know, these people are going to hell. Because there are many conservatives that are not for gay marriage rights, but they would never go as far as saying that. And I think it really has pushed the church to a much more moderate position, and now we're seeing, you know, the tipping point is that now we're seeing this moderate point becoming even more progressive. And I really do believe that we have reached a tipping point within the United Methodist Church and other churches, and that we will, in the next couple of years, see tremendous changes and victories, just as we have in the last couple of years, and this is continuing, of course, you know, with the legislation in different states. And so I'm looking forward to the next 2 years. I'm anticipating a wonderful change, and hopefully we can get back on being true Christians, you know, people representing Christ and what he taught and what he showed us.
Thank you.